Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need the shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast. Or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The death toll in Gaza, as presented by the Hamas Ministry of Health, is often reported with disclaimers in the Western media suggesting that they are exaggerated. Recent research from the University of London, led by Professor Michael Spaggett, says the Hamas figures are short by 40%, meaning the current death toll of Gazans is 100,000, or 4% of the entire population. Britain and France have agreed to coordinate their nuclear weapons without U.S. involvement. This pact, known as the Northwood Declaration, is discussed by Scottish professor Phillips O'Brien. He describes the pact as a decoupling from the U.S. without saying it. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
How high is the death toll in Gaza, really? The numbers released by the Hamas-run Ministry of Health have been dismissed by the Israeli government as being exaggerated. But recent research suggests that it might be the opposite. A new study from the University of London researcher Michael Spaggett finds that between October 7, 2023 and January 5, 2025, some 75,200 Palestinians in Gaza died a violent death as a direct result of the war. This figure is about 40% higher than the one reported by Gaza's Ministry of Health for the same period at 45,650 deaths. The ministry says 58,000 Palestinians have been killed since October 2023, but extrapolating numbers from the research puts the current Gaza death toll at over 100,000 people. Now, Michael Spaggett is a professor of economics and researcher of armed conflict at the University of London. He has led a study analyzing war-related deaths in Gaza, and he joins us now to tell us more. You recently released this study, which says that the overall number of Palestinians killed since the war in Gaza broke out back in 2023 is actually far higher than the estimates from the Hamas-run Gaza Ministry of Health. What's the top takeaway from this study?
I would say that there are three. First, you just said it, that the Ministry of Health is not undercounting the number of deaths. We found a substantially larger number of deaths than the numbers from the Ministry of Health. On the other hand, we find that the demographics put out by the Ministry of Health are broadly accurate. That is, the percentage of women, children, and elderly, which we found to be around 56%. And third, we've got the first ever estimate of nonviolent deaths in the war. And if you take that estimate and subtract off the number of deaths that you would expect to have occurred without the war, we get about 8,500 nonviolent excess deaths, that is, above baseline number of deaths.
So then, the Hamas-run Gaza Ministry of Health, it says that the number of those killed in Gaza is over 58,000. Your study estimates it's more than 75,000. Their figures have been generally accepted as relatively accurate in the past. Why might their estimates be much lower than the reality?
Because they're trying to capture deaths one by one. If you look at the information that they put out, it's a list. It lists individual people killed, and it's not really possible to capture every single death one by one in the chaotic environment of war. They're doing, I think, a remarkable job capturing what they are able to capture and to put it out with a degree of transparency that they've been putting out. But I think it's just not possible in real time to capture everything.
Israel claims at least 20,000 of those killed are Hamas operatives in Gaza. Can you verify that?
No, I can't verify that. We don't have a question on our survey that asks whether people were civilians or combatants. What I would say is that Israel has never really provided any evidence to back up that figure. It's just kind of a number that they put out there. Now, they may have behind the scenes some evidence, but if so, I would like to see it. So I'm skeptical of that number. But based on our survey, we can't really address that issue directly.
You have studied the human cost of many conflicts around the world. What stands out to you about this one in particular?
So the first thing I would say is simply the percentage of the population, the very high percentage of the population killed within a very short period of time. You can find plenty of wars in the 20, or at least some wars in the 21st century, where there have been more people killed. For example, in the Ukraine-Russia war, there have definitely been more people killed. But those are big countries with big populations, and Gaza is a very small place with a small population. So that percentage killed, which I think is now up around 4%, is really high, and especially for such a short period of time.
Thank you for telling us a little bit more about your work and your study. Michael Spaggett, a professor of economics and researcher of armed conflict from the University of London. We appreciate it.
In a striking shift for European defense, Britain and France have agreed to coordinate their nuclear arsenals for the first time. The aim is to present a united front against potential threats to the continent. It signals growing unease over America's long-term security commitments, and it marks a new chapter in Europe's efforts to assert strategic autonomy. What's known as the Northwood Declaration ties together the two countries' independent deterrents. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer made the stakes clear this morning.
This morning, we signed the Northwood Declaration, confirming for the first time that we are coordinating our independent nuclear deterrents. From today, our adversaries will know that any extreme threat to this continent would prompt a response from our two nations. There is no greater demonstration of the importance of this relationship.
And for more, I'm joined now by Phillips O'Brien. He's a professor of strategic studies and head of the School of International Relations at St. Andrews University in Scotland. Professor, it's good to have you on the program. I understand you've described this move as decoupling from the U.S. without saying it. How historically significant? So talk to me about how historically significant this is, this shift in nuclear posture from France and the UK.
Well, particularly from the UK, but also from France, because both of their nuclear deterrents, particularly the UK, has basically been inoperable without the USA. That it's been based on American technology, a lot of it, and very close cooperation. And the idea that sort of the British would go in a way to try and establish a nuclear deterrent that could be operated, developed and operated without the USA would be something quite extraordinary because they've not done anything like that before. Mm-hmm. I think it's a sign that the United States is no longer seen as quite a reliable defense partner, that the nuclear umbrella that the United States has had over Europe is no longer to be seen as quite as guaranteed as in the past, and that Europeans have to start thinking about their own security on their own terms. Mm-hmm. It's early days, but it is a very important sign. European states as a whole, and the British and the French primarily within them, have lived under American strategic dominance for now 80 years. Mm-hmm. And they haven't thought about their own security from their own points of view. They haven't thought of their own command structure. There has always been an American Supreme Allied Commander Europe, SACEUR. So the European states haven't really even bothered to think about how they would do this without an American big brother in some way standing over their shoulder. So now they have to do it. And it's a big task. And by the way, it has to extend not just beyond nuclear. It has to extend throughout a whole range of conventional capabilities. Europe has to come up with a command structure for its forces that works without the USA on the assumption the USA is not a reliable defense partner.
How do you think the Kremlin will interpret all of this?
Well, right now, I think the Kremlin is cares about beating Ukraine. I mean, you know, in some ways that the Kremlin's not going to overreact to this. Their I think, goals are, one, to win the war against Ukraine, to take as much of Ukraine as they possibly can. And then they would love to drive the United States and Europe apart. So I think they'd be, in some ways, you know, their view is if Trump actually is heading their direction, that's a great thing. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, they won't be wild about it, but I don't think it's anything that they're going to react to very strongly right now because they have other fish they're frying.
Okay. Professor Phillips O'Brien, we appreciate your time and your valuable, interesting insights tonight. Thank you.
Those interviews were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, and most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, France 24. First, a press review about the announcement by French President Macron that to be free, we must be feared, and a large increase in military spending. A press review on the 30th anniversary of the massacre of 8,000 Muslim men and boys in Srebrenica by Serbian forces during the Bosnian War. Then international comments after Israel dropped nearly 500 bombs on Syria, including Damascus, as punishment for battling with Druze forces who are Israeli allies. France 24.
You've got more on that announcement from Emmanuel Macron about that hike in defense spending.
That's right, Caris. The now famous sentence of Emmanuel Macron, to be free, we must be feared, is on the front page of the French daily Le Télégramme. The French president also said that since the world wars, freedom has never been so threatened. And according to a poll in a French right-wing paper, Le Figaro, 7 out of 10 French people approve the new defense budget. And the headline here reads, amid crisis, the French endorse their army.
Today marks 30 years since the Srebrenica genocide in Bosnia.
That's right. 30 years ago, 8,000 Muslim men and adolescent boys were slaughtered by Ratko Mladic's Serbian forces in the midst of the Balkans War. The war in Gaza shows us that we've learned nothing from Srebrenica. That's what Janine DiGiovanni says for the National and Emirati paper, comparing her experiences as a reporter during the Balkans War to what she calls the ethnic cleansing in Gaza today. In other press, you have Le Monde, the French paper, also paying tribute to the victims of Srebrenica with this front page picture here today. Between remembrance and denial, the Daily says, noting that the legacy of the genocide is still a very divisive issue in Serbia.
As tensions between Israel and Syria hit boiling point, the United States is looking to pull the two sides back from the brink. The US's top diplomat Marco Rubio citing historic long-time rivalries behind the unrest that erupted in the majority Druze city of Sweida. The State Department, while not directly naming Israel, warned the communal violence posed a direct threat to peace efforts in Syria. Meanwhile, Iran is not holding back. Fresh off a 12-day conflict with Israel, its foreign minister Abbas Araghchi is blaming Tel Aviv outright.
The rabid Israeli regime knows no bounds. The world, including the region, must unite to end its unhinged aggression.
Turkey has also condemned Israel, saying the airstrikes in Syria are part of a pattern.
Israel has for quite some time been pursuing a de facto policy of destabilization in the region. While doing so, it bases its actions solely on its own national security priorities without regard for any rules, norms, or the rights, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of other countries. As you know, this began in Gaza, then extended to the West Bank, followed by Lebanon, Iran, and now Syria.
The European Union is demanding Israel immediately cease its airstrikes, urging all actors to respect Syria's sovereignty. Meanwhile, a clear call from UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres, demanding the restoration of calm and access to humanitarian aid.
Those press reviews and report were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English, and most podcast sites. On to NHK World Radio Japan. Japanese electronics firm Panasonic opened a $4 billion plant in Kansas building batteries for electric vehicles. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese met with Chinese President Xi during a six-day visit to the country. They agreed to treat each other equally, though they then critiqued each other's large military exercises. A new law banning children under 16 from using social media in Australia comes into effect in December. NHK Japan.
A subsidiary of Japanese electronics giant Panasonic Holdings has started mass producing EV batteries at a factory in the U.S. state of Kansas. Panasonic Energy held a ceremony on Monday. The company has invested $4 billion to build the plant. It's the company's second factory in the United States. The facility's annual output capacity is expected to be enough to power 450,000 electric vehicles. There are plans to hire up to 4,000 workers, but the full production that was initially targeted by the end of March 2027 has been effectively postponed. That's partly due to falling sales at the company's key customer, Tesla. Another unfavorable factor for Panasonic is that U.S. tax breaks for EV purchases are set to expire in September. This will likely mean a challenging business climate, just as the company is trying to diversify its customer base.
Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has met with China's President Xi Jinping during a six-day visit to the country. The two leaders held talks in Beijing on Tuesday and agreed to strengthen bilateral ties.
A commitment to equal treatment, to seeking common ground while sharing differences, pursuing mutually beneficial cooperation, serves the fundamental interests of our two countries and our people.
Australia values our relationship with China and will continue to approach it in a calm and consistent manner, guided by our national interest.
The meeting came against the backdrop of U.S. President Donald Trump's sweeping trade tariffs. China is Australia's largest trading partner, and the two leaders agreed to maintain an open dialogue. Albanese said he raised concerns over the Chinese Navy's live-fire exercises in waters between Australia and New Zealand in February. The Prime Minister said she responded by saying both countries conduct exercises. As Albanese conducts diplomacy in Beijing, China is likely to keep a close eye on Australia's largest ever military exercises now underway. More than 35,000 personnel from 19 countries, including the United States, Japan, Britain, and India, are taking part.
It's nations that are in search of a common aspiration for peace, stability, a free and open Indo-Pacific, and adherence to international law.
The exercises, codenamed Talisman Sabre, began on Sunday. It's the 11th time they've been held. Over the next 3 weeks, amphibious landings, air combat, and maritime operations will be conducted across the continent. For the first time, some drills will also take place outside Australia in Papua New Guinea, the country's closest neighbor. On Monday, Australia fired its newly acquired U.S.-made HIMARS long-range rocket system for the first time. The rockets are capable of striking targets up to 400 kilometers away and are in high demand in Ukraine. Australia has purchased the artillery system as China builds up its military. China is expected to deploy surveillance ships to monitor the exercises, something Albanese described as nothing unusual.
A new law banning Australians under the age of 16 from using social media takes effect in December. The ban will likely include major platforms such as Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok.
Meanwhile, an opinion poll taken last November shows 77% of Australians aged 18 and over support the new law. Parents have mixed feelings about the ban. Joanna Tassoni in Sydney has three children aged 11 to 15. Tassoni believes social media use should be restricted, but she also feels it has become indispensable for her children who had to take classes and communicate with friends online during the COVID-19 lockdown. South Australia's Premier had commissioned the report that formed the basis of the new law. He acknowledges that social media has some positive aspects, but questions its business model.
When social media business models depend upon childhood addiction, we know that there is a responsibility for government to act. These social media companies have operated beyond their social license. They have not acted in the interests of children. They've acted in the interests of their own profits.
With social media now a mainstream means of communication, Australians are trying to find answers to protect vulnerable children. Jennifer Walpole, NHK World, Sydney.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 13710 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. All the times they announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. NHK is available at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report, or could help support this program like subscribers in Cleveland and Nevada did this week, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever donated to help keep this freely distributed show on the airwaves. Please help if you can. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. 30 countries are at a meeting at a summit in Colombia to find a way to stop the war in Gaza. The collection of countries is called the Hague Group and were addressed by Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur for Occupied Palestine. A new Freedom Flotilla has left Italy to try to bring aid to Palestine. The crew includes a trade unionist from the US and several parliamentarians. Radio Havana, Cuba.
United Nations Special Rapporteur for the Occupied Palestinian Territory said that it is time for nations around the world to take concrete actions to stop Israel's genocide in Gaza. Francesca Albanese spoke to delegates from 30 countries meeting in Colombia's capital, Bogota, on Tuesday to discuss Israel's brutal assault and ways that nations can try to stop the offensive in the besieged Gaza Strip. The Israeli economy is structured to sustain the occupation that has now turned into genocide. The two-day conference, which continues today, Wednesday, organized by Colombia and South Africa, is being attended mostly by developing nations, although Spain, Ireland, and China have also sent delegates. The conference is co-chaired by South Africa and Colombia, which last year suspended coal exports to Israeli power plants. It includes the participation of members of the Hague Group, a coalition of eight countries that earlier this year, in January, pledged to cut military ties with Israel and comply with the International Criminal Court arrest warrant against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The gathering comes as the European Union weighs various measures against Israel, which include a ban on exports from illegal Israeli settlements, an arms embargo, and individual sanctions against Israeli officials who are found to be blocking a peaceful solution to the conflict. Colombian Minister for Foreign Affairs, Mauricio Jaramillo, said that the nations participating in the Bogota meeting, which also include Qatar and Turkey, will be discussing diplomatic and judicial measures to put more pressure on Israel to stop its attacks. Only weeks after the crew of the boat Madeleine was intercepted and abducted in international waters by Israeli occupation forces, the Freedom Flotilla Coalition is sailing once again. The Handala, carrying essential supplies, including food, medicine, and other goods, began its voyage on Sunday from Italy with 18 crew members on board, including trade unionists and parliamentarians such as U.S. labor organizer Christian Smalls, French Member of Parliament Emma Floreau, and Member of Parliament Gabriel Catala. Michelle Borgia, spokesperson for the Freedom Coalition Italy, told People's Dispatch that beyond the flotilla's consistent message of solidarity with the Palestinian people, this mission has an additional focus, the children of Gaza. She said that thousands of Palestinian children, including babies, have been killed in Israel's ongoing attacks. And she said the ship's cargo includes baby formula, very important. Since Israel broke the ceasefire in March, imposing a blockade on all humanitarian aid to Gaza, food, fuel, and water, children have starved to death as formula and food remain out of reach. She also said that there were many reports of children and parents being targeted while waiting in line for food, specifically for baby formula. The specific link to Gaza's children has also promoted a call to action for southern Italy. Puglia was the first in the country to officially support severing ties with Israel. The mission of the Handala, like that of the Madeleine and other voyages of the Freedom Flotilla, go beyond delivering material aid. In many ways, a political statement. For years, Israel has maintained and undermined Palestinians' ability to fish or even farm. This has forced Palestinians in Gaza into complete dependency on aid, with devastating consequences for their sense of dignity and self-sufficiency. Freedom Flotilla Italy has taken an important role in organizing the departure. On Sunday, the ship is now on its way to Gaza, coordinated aspects of technical and logistical preparations. This chapter draws links to Palestine solidarity mobilizations in the early 2000s, including the work of journalist and activist Vittorio Arioni, who joined a mission that successfully reached Gaza.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information to make online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report's been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I'm still recuperating from spinal injuries, I'm staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.